Good morning. My name is Michael. I'm a member of the COCAR Biogeochemistry Lab at MIT, and I'm here to talk about radium and uranium transport and some of the experimental and modeling work that we've done to explore that. The reason we care about uranium and radium in the environment is that they are primarily contaminants. Uranium is a heavy metal. When ingested, it has a toxic effect on the body. Radium is radioactive and is also the parent product to radon, which when can accumulate in unventilated, basements, other kinds of buildings. Both of these isotopes are naturally occurring. This plot here is from produced water from a shale deep in the surface. They're high activity, and this is the radium activity in picocuries per liter. And there's very, very high activities. And this is just natural in this water, right? The permanent discharge limit for a hydraulic fracturing operation is at this level, and then the drinking water limit defined by the EPA is at this level here. It's only 5 picocuries per liter. So there's these deep natural shales have lots of hazard basically associated with them, and when we bring these materials up to the surface, they can be a risk if they're mishandled. In a similar vein, processing of uranium ores and the development of nuclear energy and weapons has resulted in contamination on many different sites. As one example, we have the uranium-contaminated site in Rifle, Colorado, which remains contaminated, basically, in spite of many years of study. And so we want to be able to predict where these radioactive and dangerous metals are going to go in the environment. And the reason we look at uranium and radium together somewhat is that they have linked radiochemistry. Uranium is a parent product for radium. It's kind of higher up in the decay chain. But when we try to predict their transport, we run into some trouble. The first thing that drives this is that their geochemistries are significantly different. Radium is dominated by sorption processes and co-precipitation, whereas uranium has a large number of different processes that will control its solubility and fate in a natural aquifer, including the redox state of your aquifer. To compound all of these differences, we also have to worry about the physical heterogeneity of a natural porous material, as you can see here, as well as the biogeochemical heterogeneity. And that includes different mineral phases, small microbial communities, all kinds of that thing. And so if we want to make better predictions, we need to study this at a more like process-based scale, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. We've got kind of 3 vignettes that I'm going to talk through to develop this process-based understanding of uranium and radium transport in the environment. And I'm going to do this, these basically 3 projects that we've been working on. We've got some batch studies looking at radium sorption, some geochemical modeling of that radium sorption, and then lastly, I'm going to talk about some microfluidic device projects that we've been working on, which will allow us to investigate these processes in situ in flow conditions. So the reason we start with batch experiments on radium sorption is because the knowledge on radium sorption is relatively limited. In the literature, there are some studies to natural sediments, a couple of the iron oxides, some manganese oxides, but for the most part, there's not a comprehensive understanding of what will specifically control radium retention in a natural aquifer. And so our goal here is to predict and compare the mineral-specific sorption under a variety of geochemical conditions that might be seen. Right? And the method is that we do sorption isotherms, and then we also do concurrently cation competition studies. So the first set of data I'm going to show you, these are radium sorption isotherm results. On this vertical axis, I have a KD, it's a linear KD sorption isotherm. And then on the bottom axis, I have the pH. And I've got 4 different minerals, 2 iron hydroxides, ferrihydrite and goethite, 2-to-1 layer clay, sodium montmorillonite, and then pyrite, which is a reduced iron mineral. What's immediately obvious is that for the iron hydroxides, we have a very strong dependence on pH, which aligns with a lot of the behavior that's been studied for other metals. And then for pyrite and for sodium montmorillonite, we see some pH-dependent behavior, but for the most part, it's relatively constant. Something notable is that pyrite, which is not traditionally thought as a retaining material, actually sorbs comparatively to other iron hydroxides in lower circumneutral pH ranges. When we then look at the, this is a subset of my data, but when we look at the influence of different background cation solutions, all at this relatively the same ionic strength, including a mixed cation solution, an artificial groundwater, we see some differences as compared to the surface isotherms. When we look at ferrihydrate, we see that the background cation has some kind of effect, but for like a mixed cation solution, there's not a huge change in the amount of sorption. However, for sodium montmorillonite, which, as I'll jump back for a second, is relatively dominant over the pH range in a 10 millimolar sodium chloride background, huge changes occur when you introduce the mixed cation. And so we've begun here to understand like what are the key parameters that we need to worry about, and it's dependent on the mineralogy of the system that we're trying to study. But we don't have a lot of predictive capability, and that leads me into this next vignette that I wanted to talk through, where we try to model this radium sorption. What we're going to use is kind of a classic surface complexation model. It's a double diffuse layer modeled after Zombach and Morell's type of work, and allows us to include specific processes. As an example, we can include for the sodium montmorillonite exchange of radium with the inner layer cations of the clay, or sorption onto surface sites. And when we do this fitting, we either fit the results from my sorption isotherms, or we fit the data from the cation competition experiments. It gives us some a data set that we can compare and contrast against. So the key processes that we consider when we do the surface complexation, our surface complexation modeling, are follows. We cover surface protonation, we fit radium surface complexation reactions. We then include background cation surface complexation reactions, and these are drawn from the literature. We don't fit these ourselves. And lastly, when necessary, and this was necessary for the clay mineral, we consider exchange with interlayer cations. So this is an example data plot for our best fit of radium sorption to ferrihydrate using the cation competition data. On the bottom axis, we have the predicted fraction sorbed from the simulation compared against the experimental. And what we would hope is that when we run this model, we all of our data points fall in this nice one-to-one trend line. But we don't see that because there are some issues, basically, with how the model represents the different cations. When we try to, if we fit our data to a sorption isotherm instead, and then import it into this kind of space and compare it with the competing cations, we find that the fits don't work as well. And so there's this kind of lack of interchangeability that highlights maybe a weakness with surface complexation modeling. But that said, we've been able to highlight what the kind of key processes that are at play. Right, so we understand radium transport a little bit better now. But we need to kind of further constrain what will happen when radium occurs in these heterogeneous physical and geochemical systems. And in a similar fashion, uranium is better studied in terms of its kind of batch characteristics, but that understanding still needs to be developed. And we really want to do this, develop this at the pore scale. Again, this is just to remind you, we've got this, you know, naturally complicated porous media. And the way we're tackling this is through the use of microfluidic devices. Essentially, we take silicon or PDMS and we make a small flow channel inside of it, and it's something we're currently working on. The reason we choose a microfluidic device as opposed to, say, like a column study, they allow us to examine things in situ, and they allow us to control the heterogeneity that we want to include. You can choose the pattern of pores that you want. It can be a realistic pattern. It can be a more idealized pattern. We can include mineral phases. We can exclude mineral phases. And it allows us to image these processes in situ through microscopy, various X-ray absorption, X-ray fluorescence techniques, and Raman spectroscopy. In particular, we've been trying to develop the capacity to do X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy, particularly micro X-ray fluorescence. This image on the left, we have a kind of a pilot device where we precipitated a manganese oxide in the cell, which you can see in this kind of black line that runs through the device. That's the solid that's precipitated. We took this device to the Stanford synchrotron light source and tried to image the manganese oxide. And we were eventually able to do this, but it was only after destroying the cell, kind of cutting it open, that we were able to do this mapping. We want to be able to do this kind of mapping in situ because manganese oxides, iron oxides are very important. And this highlights a limitation that we ran across, which is that your typical slide, which is 500 microns, will allow you to do fluorescence spectroscopy for uranium, but it doesn't allow you to do fluorescence spectroscopy for low-Z elements such as iron and manganese. And so this is something we wanted to work on. Can we basically find a different substrate to cover these devices so that we can image them in situ? And we have. We found a 30-micron glass, and we've been able to image an iron oxide through that. The bright red-orange spots are basically where the iron oxide is. The blue spots are where it isn't. And this is just kind of a dummy slide. But we've covered a microfluidic device with this glass. And you can see here that we are also able to image it. We've got a fluorescent dye here, and then we're able to image only the fluorescent dye using kind of using a light filter. So in conclusion, I've illustrated some key minerals and geochemical conditions that will control absorption of radium. We've discussed kind of strengths and weaknesses of radium sorption surface complexation modeling, but we need to do some further refinement if we want to develop a predictive capability. And then lastly, we've demonstrated this capability to image low-Z elements in situ in a microfluidic device. And so what we plan to do with this is we want to study uranium release from anoxic micropore domains, because that's an important process highlighted at like Rifle, for example. And we also want to examine how radium sorption will change when mineralogy changes. Pyrite can easily be oxidized and form iron hydroxide coatings, and that will affect radium transport in the long term. This work has many, many collaborators across many different spaces. I'd like to highlight Neha Mehta, who is a member of the COCAR lab, Mitch Glenick, who has helped us with kind of working with these radioactive elements. He's at MIT EHS. And Kurt Broderick at the MIT Microtechnology Labs, who helped me figure out how to make these microfluidic devices. Also highlighting the teams at SLAC National Accelerator Lab for helping me gather the X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy. And that's all I got to say for now. Any questions?
Yes, for the absorption of the radium,
Sorry, say that again?
What kind of the particle size do you use for the absorption of the radium?
So for the clay, we filter down to the less than 2 micron fraction. For pyrite, we ground it to, I don't remember the mesh size off the top of my head. It's like 45 micron to 200 micron. And then the iron hydroxides are naturally fabricated. The clay mineral, because it came from a natural source, we had to pre-treat using kind of standard methods. We equilibrate it with concentrated sodium chloride, and then equilibrate it with our background solution. Pyrite, we needed to acid wash, and we actually handled anoxically. But the iron hydroxide minerals, we just were able to synthesize and use as is after washing.
So that's the question synthesizing the
nanite,
right?
Yeah. It's a big question that is not clear from the literature. There's some evidence that suggests that dissolved organic matter and even particulate organic matter may influence the sorption of radium and uranium, but there's not been a lot of work into investigating why or what functional groups are controlling that. It's actually a really great area that would be a good place to do some research.